Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell, Susan Shand, and Brian Lynn. Later, Steve Ember will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
Nearly every U.S. medical school gives new students a white coat and a stethoscope. The act is part of a long tradition. But it is more than just symbolic. Medical schools still teach stethoscope skills. Doctors must be able to use them well to get their licenses. But the stethoscope, 200 years after its invention, is facing an uncertain future. New devices can help doctors find problems in the heart, lungs, and other areas. They use ultrasound technology, artificial intelligence, and smartphone apps. Dr. Eric Topol is a world-renowned heart doctor. He considers the stethoscope obsolete, in other words, old and out of date. It was okay for 200 years, Topol said, but we need to go beyond that. We can do better. Students at Indiana University, one of the nation's largest medical schools, learn stethoscope skills. But they also get training in handheld ultrasound technology. The training is part of a program launched there last year by Dr. Paul Wallach, one of the school's leaders. 5 years ago, he created a similar program at the Medical College of Georgia. Wallach believes that within the next 10 years, handheld ultrasound devices will become part of the usual physical exam, just like the reflex hammer. But Wallach added that he isn't ready to declare the stethoscope dead. He believes younger doctors will be wearing a stethoscope around the neck and an ultrasound in the pocket. Modern-day stethoscopes look different than the first stethoscope. It was invented in the early 1800s by Frenchman René Laennec. But the devices work in basically the same way. Sound waves make the device's flat metal area shake. The shaking moves the sound through the tubes to the ears. But hearing and understanding sounds from the human body requires a trained ear. Dr. James Thomas is a heart doctor at Northwestern Medicine in Chicago. He says that with medical advances and competing devices, some younger doctors are not being trained well on the stethoscope. He notes recent studies that medical school graduates in some areas may miss as many as half of murmurs using a stethoscope. There is, however, a large price difference between normal stethoscopes and high-tech devices. Stethoscopes usually cost under $200, compared with at least a few thousand dollars for some of the new devices. Dr. Dave Drelishars has been a doctor for children for more than 10 years. He understands the attraction of the newer devices. But, he says, until the price comes down, the stethoscope is still your best tool. He said, "During my work hours in my office, if I don't have it around my shoulders, it's as though I was feeling almost naked." I'm John Russell.
Seeing the possibility of a loss of freedoms in their future, Hong Kong students are increasingly deciding to study in Taiwan, Radio Free Asia has learned. Sophia Ma helps lead the Taipei Economic and Cultural Office in Hong Kong. She said students from Hong Kong are showing more interest in universities and higher education institutions in Taiwan. I think that has something to do with recent problems we have seen in Hong Kong, Ma said. I think we will likely see more Hong Kong students coming to study in Taiwan as a result, she added. Applications will soon be accepted for students wishing to study for a bachelor's degree at a Taiwan university. Recently, there were more than 80 higher education institutions from Taiwan that attended an education fair at the Kowloon Bay International Trade and Exhibition Center. Taiwan is already popular with students from Hong Kong. More than 1,600 students enrolled in Taiwanese universities last year. This year, older people also are applying to study, possibly because they hope to live on the island after graduation. It is a road to permanent residency offered under Taiwan's immigration rules. Lin Yu Chan is an assistant professor at Taiwan's Wenzhou Ursuline University of Languages. He said he had seen several older people who want to attend Taiwanese universities this year. So this year is very unusual. There are fathers and mothers with children who are applying to go to university in Taiwan. It's a new phenomenon. Lin said his booth at the fair had run out of informational materials halfway through the day because so many people were interested. A man called Xi took his son to the event. He said he wanted his son to leave the city because of the protests and the political atmosphere there. He said he liked the learning environment in Taiwan. Many of my friends have had similar ideas and want to send their kids overseas to study, he said. Young people at the exhibition told RFA that the political crisis in Hong Kong is making overseas study more interesting. Some had plans to apply to schools in Taiwan. Others said they would prefer Britain, the United States, or Canada. Sophia Ma said that universities in Taiwan had easier admission requirements than Hong Kong universities. They also teach subjects that are in demand, including science and agriculture. For some students, it may be a way to leave the uncertainty of Hong Kong's political future behind. I'm Susan Shand.
Mice and rats have long been used in medical research because of their biological similarities to humans. The tiny animals have already shown an ability to recognize objects, push buttons, and find their way through complex paths. Now, scientists have trained rats to drive small vehicles created for them. One of the main findings of the experiment was that the driving activity seemed to help the rats relax. Researchers at the University of Richmond in Virginia led the experiment. Their findings were published in Behavioral Brain Research. The team built tiny cars out of plastic and other materials. The vehicles had an opening at one end where electrical wires were attached. By touching one of three different wires, the rat could steer the car in different directions, left, center, and right. Sweet treats were placed inside the experiment containers in an attempt to get the rats to drive the vehicle to get to the food. Researchers trained 17 rats over several months to drive around the containers. The animals proved that they could be trained to drive forward as well as in other directions to get to the treats. Kelly Lambert of the University of Richmond helped lead the experiment. She told the French news agency AFP the research suggests that rat brains may be more complex and flexible than once thought. Lambert said she had long been interested in neuroplasticity, or the way the brain changes to react to different experiences and difficulties. She found that rats kept in what she calls enriched environments performed far better than those in labs. While she expected that result, Lambert told AFP, "It was actually quite shocking to me that they were so much better." The researchers examined levels of two hormones in the rats, one that causes stress and another that counters it. All rats that took part in the training had higher levels of the hormone that reduces stress. The research suggests the increased relaxation levels could be linked to the enjoyment of successfully completing a new skill. The team also found that the rats that drove themselves showed higher levels of the stress-fighting hormone than those that simply rode in small cars controlled by humans. Lambert said the most exciting result of the experiment for her was about the possible effect on humans. The research may open new areas of non-drug treatments for people suffering from mental health conditions. There's no cure for schizophrenia or depression, and we need to catch up, she said. And I think we need to look at different animal models and different types of tasks and really respect that behavior can change our neurochemistry. Speaking to the British-based magazine New Scientist, Lambert said her team is planning to continue experiments to learn more about how the rats learned to drive. The new research will also examine why some activities appear to reduce stress and which areas of the brain are involved in the process. As an example, Lambert said new driving tests could be created to test the effects of Parkinson's disease on motor skills and awareness of space. If we use more realistic and challenging models, it may provide more meaningful data, she told New Scientist. I'm Brian Lynn.
From
VOA Learning English. Welcome to the Making of a Nation. I'm Steve Ember. In 1850, the northern and southern states threatened to split over the issue of slavery. At that time, owning slaves was legal in the southern states. Many northerners opposed slavery, and the question remained, should slavery be legal in new territories in the western part of the country? The two sides disagreed strongly, but the issue needed to be settled. So Senator Henry Clay of Kentucky offered a compromise. Conservative Southern lawmakers rejected it. John C. Calhoun of South Carolina especially spoke against the compromise, but other lawmakers supported it, including one of the nation's top political leaders. Senator Daniel Webster of Massachusetts said the compromise was the only way to save the Union of States. 4 days after Webster's speech, Senator William Seward of New York presented his ideas to the Senate and to the nation. Seward was a northerner. He said he opposed any compromise with the South. He said he did not want slavery in the new Western territories, and he called for a national policy to start peacefully ending slavery everywhere. Seward criticized Daniel Webster for speaking against abolition societies. He said such groups represented a moral movement that could not be stopped. He said the movement would continue until all the slaves in America were free. Seward then criticized John C. Calhoun. He denounced Calhoun's demands for a political balance between the North and South. He said this forced balance would change the United States from a united national democracy to an alliance of independent states. In such a system, he said, the minority would be able to veto actions of the majority. A few weeks after Seward spoke, John C. Calhoun died. One newspaper in Calhoun's home state said, "The senator's death is best for the country and his own honor. The slavery question will now be settled." Calhoun would have blocked a settlement. In fact, many lawmakers had come to support the idea of Senator Henry Clay's compromise, but they could not agree on which parts of it to pass first. Southern supporters were afraid that if a statehood bill for California was passed first, then Northerners would refuse to pass the other parts of the compromise. So Southerners wanted to include all parts in one bill. A committee of 13 men was named to write a bill based on Henry Clay's compromise. The committee had 6 members from slave states and 6 from free states. Senator Clay was named to lead it. 3 weeks later, the committee offered its bill. It was much like the compromise Clay had first proposed. It made California a free state. It created territorial governments for New Mexico and Utah. It settled the border dispute between Texas and New Mexico. It ended the slave trade in the nation's capital, the District of Columbia, and it urged approval of a new law dealing with runaway slaves. For about a month, the bill seemed to have the support of President Zachary Taylor. But then the president made it clear that he would do everything he could to defeat it. Taylor did not think the nation was in crisis. He did not believe the dispute over slavery was as serious as others did. He had his own plan to settle one part of the dispute. He would make the new territory of California a free state. There, slavery would be banned. Taylor's plan did not, however, settle other parts of the dispute. It said nothing about laws on escaped slaves. It said nothing about slavery in the District of Columbia. It also said nothing about the border dispute between Texas and New Mexico. Senator Clay, who had offered the compromise, questioned President Taylor's limited proposal. Clay said, "Now, what is the plan of the president? Here are five problems, five wounds that are bleeding and threatening the life of the republic. What is the president's plan? Is it to heal all these wounds? No such thing. It is to heal one of the five and to leave the other four to bleed more than ever." While the debate continued in Washington, the situation in Texas and New Mexico got worse. Texas claimed a large part of New Mexico, including the capital, Santa Fe. Early in 1850, Texas sent a representative to Santa Fe to take control of the government. The United States military commander in New Mexico advised the people not to recognize the man. The governor of Texas was furious. He decided to send state soldiers to enforce Texas's claims in New Mexico. He said if trouble broke out, the United States government would be to blame. President Taylor rejected Texas's claims. He told his Secretary of War to send an order to the military commander in New Mexico. The commander was to use force to oppose any attempt by Texas to seize the territory. The Secretary of War said he would not send such an order. He believed that if fighting began, Southerners would hurry to the aid of Texas. And that, he thought, might be the start of a Southern struggle against the federal government. In a short time, the North and South would be at war. So the Secretary of War refused to sign the order. President Taylor answered sharply, "Then I will sign the order myself." Taylor had been a general before becoming president. He said he would take command of the army himself to enforce the law. And he said he was willing to hang anyone who rebelled against the Union. President Taylor began writing a message to Congress on the situation. He never finished it. On July 4, 1850, Taylor attended an outdoor Independence Day ceremony. The event was held on the grounds where a monument to America's first president, George Washington, was being built. The day was very hot, and Taylor stood for a long time in the burning sun. That night, he became sick with pains in his stomach. Doctors were called to the White House, but none of their treatments worked. 5 days later, President Zachary Taylor died. His vice president, Millard Fillmore, was sworn in as president. Millard Fillmore was from New York State. His family was poor. His early education came not from school teachers, but from whatever books he could find. Later, Fillmore was able to study law. He became a successful lawyer. He also served in the United States Congress for 8 years. The Whig Party chose him as its candidate for vice president in the election of 1848. He served in the office for about a year and a half before the death of President Taylor. Fillmore had disagreed with Taylor over the Congressional Compromise on Slavery and the Western Territories. Unlike Taylor, Fillmore truly believed that the nation was facing a crisis, and he truly believed the compromise would help save the Union. Now, as president, Fillmore offered his complete support to the compromise bill. Its chances of passing looked better than ever. Fillmore asked the old cabinet to resign. He named his own cabinet members. All were strong supporters of the Union. All supported the compromise. Congress debated the compromise bill throughout the summer of 1850. The bill included several proposals. Supporters decided not to vote on the proposals as one piece of legislation. They saw a better chance of success by trying to pass each proposal separately. Their idea worked. By the end of September, both the Senate and House of Representatives had approved all parts of the 1850 Compromise. President Fillmore signed them into law. One part of the compromise permitted California to enter the Union as a free state. One established territorial governments in New Mexico and Utah. One settled the dispute between Texas and New Mexico. Another ended the slave trade in the District of Columbia. Many happy celebrations took place when Americans heard that President Fillmore had signed the 1850 Compromise. Many people believed the problem of slavery had been solved. They believed the Union had been saved. Others, however, believed the problem only had been postponed. They hoped the delay would give reasonable people of the North and South time to find a permanent answer to the issue of slavery. Time was running out. It was true that the 1850 Compromise had ended a national crisis, but both Northern and Southern extremists remained bitter. Those opposed to slavery believed the compromise law on runaway slaves violated the Constitution. The issue of slavery was linked to the issue of secession. Did states have the right to leave the Union? If Southern states rejected all compromises on slavery, did they have the right to secede? The signing of the 1850 Compromise cooled the debate for a time, but disagreement on the issues was deep. It would continue to build over the next 10 years.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.